Hi, and welcome to the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine, the March 11th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And this week we're going to start with The View. Ukraine can't win the war. This is by Anatoly Lievin. The long-awaited counteroffensive last year failed. Russia has recaptured Avakovo, its biggest war gain in 9 months. President Vladimir Zelensky has been forced to quietly acknowledge the new military reality. The Biden administration strategy is now to sustain Ukrainians' defenses until after the U.S. presidential elections, in the hope of wearing down Russian forces in a long war of attrition. This strategy seems sensible enough, but contains one crucially important implication and one potentially disastrous flaw, which are not yet being seriously addressed in public debates in the West or in the Ukraine. The implication of Ukraine standing indefinitely on the defensive, even if it does so successfully, is that the territories currently occupied by Russia are lost. Russia will never agree at the negotiating table to surrender land that it has managed to hold on to in the battlefield. This does not mean that Ukraine should be asked to formally surrender these lands for what would be impossible for any Ukrainian government. But it does mean that, as Zelensky proposed early in the war with regard to Crimea and eastern Donbas, the territorial issue will have to be shelved for future talks. As we know from Cyprus, which has been divided between the internationally recognized Greek Republic of Cyprus and the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus since 1974, such negotiations can continue for decades without a solution or a renewed conflict. A situation in which Ukraine retains its independence, its freedom to develop as a Western democracy, and 82% of its legal territory, including all of the core historic lands, would have been regarded by previous generations of Ukrainians as a real victory, though not a complete one. As I found in Ukraine last year, many Ukrainians in private were prepared to accept the loss of some territories as the price of peace, if Ukraine failed to win them back on the battlefield, and if the alternative was years of bloody war with little prospect of success. The Biden administration needs to get America on board as well. Yet supporters of complete Ukrainian victory have engaged in the hopes that range from overly optimistic to the magical. At the magical end of the spectrum is the notion, set out by retired U.S. Army General Ben Hodges, among others, that Russia can be defeated and even driven from Crimea by long-range missile bombardment. This is folly. Ukrainians have scored some notable successes against the Russian Black Sea Fleet, but to take back Crimea, they would need to be able to launch a massive amphibious landing, an exceptionally difficult operation far beyond their capabilities in terms of ships and men. Attacks on the Russian infrastructure are pinpricks given Russia's size and resources. More realistic is the suggestion that by standing on the defensive this year, Ukrainians can inflict such losses on the Russians that, if supplied with more Western weaponry, they can counterattack successfully in 2025. However, this depends on the Russians playing the game the way Kyiv and Washington want to play it. The Russian strategy at present appears to be different. They've drawn Ukrainians into prolonged battles for small amounts of territory, where they have relied on Russian superiority in artillery and munitions to wear them down through constant bombardment. They are firing 3 shells to every 1 Ukrainian, and thanks in part to help from Iran, Russia now has been able to deploy very large numbers of drones. For Ukrainians to stand a chance, military history suggests that they would need a 3-2 advantage in manpower and considerably more firepower. Ukraine enjoyed these advantages in the first year of the war, but now they lie with Russia, and it's very difficult to see how the Ukraine can recover from that. The Biden administration is entirely correct to warn that without further massive U.S. military aid, Ukrainian resistance is likely to collapse this year. But U.S. officials also need to recognize that even if this aid continues, there's no realistic chance of total Ukrainian victory next year or the year after that. Even if the Ukrainians can build up their forces, Russia can deepen its defenses even more. The Biden administration has a strong incentive to test President Vladimir Putin on the sincerity or insincerity of his statements that Russia is ready for peace talks. A successful peace process would undoubtedly involve some painful concessions by the Ukraine and the West. Yet the pain would be more emotional than practical, and a peace settlement would have to involve Putin giving up the plan with which he began the war to turn the whole of Ukraine into a Russian vassal state and recognizing the territorial integrity of Ukraine within its de facto present borders. For the lost Ukrainian territories are lost, and the NATO membership is pointless if the alliance is not prepared to send its own troops to fight for the Ukraine against Russia. Above all, however painful a peace agreement would be today, it would infinitely more so if the war continues and Ukraine is defeated. Lievin, the writer of this article, directs the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statescraft and is co-author of the new book, The Diplomatic Path to a Secure Ukraine. Next, we have the risk report. Myanmar and their war with itself. And this is by Ian Bremmer. It's been 3 years since Myanmar's ruling junta clawed back power and from an elected government, and its grip on power is becoming costlier for all concerned. Recent fights with well-armed ethnic groups have inflicted heavier casualties on the country's military. The Defense Ministry admitted in March of 2023 that 14,000 troops had deserted since the coup. The true number was surely higher then and is much higher now. Add the army's broad unpopularity to public fears that troops have become cannon fodder and recruiting isn't going well either. That's why the generals have announced that beginning in April, their government will conscript 50,000 to 60,000 citizens per year under the so-called People's Military Service Law. This statute is not new. A previous military government put it on the books in 2010, but never needed to use it. But today's desperate times call for more desperate measures that allows the army to draft any man between the ages of 18 to 35 and any woman between the ages of 18 to 27. Draftees can be ordered to serve for up to 5 years. The junta has also announced that retired military personnel will be called back into service, also for up to 5 years, under another emergency law. The Army knows that draft notices risk serious public unrest, and it's not at all clear that more troops will help. Yet the junta won't go down easily. It may not have the monopoly on military firepower it would like, but it still has the best and most powerful weapons, and can still contain dissent, even if the cost is rising. The current battleground stalemate with rebel groups will likely continue. A continuing ceasefire in one region will help focus the fight in others. Nor will outsiders play a game-changing role. U.S. sanctions, including a few more introduced in late January on the third anniversary of the coup that returned the generals to power, won't persuade them to restore democracy. Myanmar's government can continue to work around them. Amnesty International reported in January that Myanmar's government is able to evade restrictions by using third parties to import crucial resources like aviation fuel. In particular, the generals know how they can still count on friends in China for trade and investment deals, and both China and Russia for the sale of their weapons. The continuing conflict inside Myanmar also generates worsening news for its neighbors. Efforts to draft large numbers of new civilians to send them off to fight will fuel a substantial increase in the number of refugees and illegal migrants pouring across Myanmar's borders into neighboring countries, particularly Thailand and India. Since the 2021 coup, an estimated 45,000 Myanmar citizens have sought refuge in Thailand by crossing a border region that's already home to some 90,000 refugees who have been there for the past 40 years. For its part, Thailand says about 2 million documented Myanmar migrants were working legally in that country in late 2022, but as many as 5 million are thought to be living and laboring there off the books. The junta and Thailand's government aren't publicly discussing the problem. An additional 60,000 refugees have piled into India from Myanmar since the 2021 coup. India's government, aware that rival China enjoys close ties with the generals, has tried to engage them, but it can't be sure the junta has the power to bring the humanitarian crisis and Myanmar's political stability under control. It also fears that ethnic violence inside Myanmar could trigger similar clashes on the Indian side of the border. Surges in Myanmar's drug production and trafficking have likewise spilled into neighboring countries. For now, Myanmar's military rulers are neither strong enough to win nor damaged enough to lose, and the never-ending battle for control of this benighted nation will grind on. Let's head over to the brief. As the ice melts, polar bears will scrounge for food, and this is by Jeffrey Kluger. It's not easy to swim 109 miles when you're starving to death. It's not easy either to try to survive when you're shedding body weight at a rate of 2.2 pounds a day. And it might be the hardest, or at least the most tragic of all, if you're a nursing mom and your calorie intake has dropped so low that you can no longer produce the milk that you need to care for your young. As a new paper in Nature Communications reveals, all of those challenges and more are facing the world's polar bears. Thanks to the vanishing sea ice in the warming world, denying the animals a platform that they need to hunt for seals. If the trend is not reversed soon, the estimated 26,000 polar bears in the wild could start to lose their hold on survival before the middle of the century. The researchers were less interested in establishing the fact that the bears' food plight, scientists are already aware of that problem. What they were more focused on was learning was both how gravely the nutritional loss is affecting the animal's health and the alternative food sources that they're scrounging for on land. To do their work, the scientists followed 20 different polar bears in Manitoba, Canada, from 2019 to 2022, fitting them with GPS trackers and video collars and periodically tranquilizing them to analyze, among others, their blood, their body mass, and their daily energy expenditure, basically a measure of calorie coming in and calorie going out. The polar bears in Hudson Bay are probably at the edge of the range at which they can survive right now, says Anthony Pagano, a research biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and the lead author of the paper. Most of the modeling work suggests that around the year 2050, they're going to be on land and away from their primary habitat on the ice. The contraction in range of the Hudson Bay community is likely to be reflected in the ranges of the 18 other polar bear subpopulations scattered throughout the Arctic as well. Across the arc of the study, the data gathered was troubling. Weight loss varied amongst the bears, with a daily loss of 2.2 pounds representing an average. Some of the subjects dropped up to 3.75 pounds every 24 hours. That may not seem like much when an adult male polar bear can tip the scales at 1,200 pounds and a female at 700 pounds, but that can add up fast. And with less available to eat, the hungry bears have to travel farther to find their next meal. A young female that swam approximately 109 miles set the record for the bears studied. These endurance swims in search of food are energy intensive and often fruitless. The bears are effective hunters when they've got the purchase of ice beneath them, but they're clumsy when they're going after seals and trying to swim at the same time. That leaves them scavenging on land for food that would not ordinarily be eaten by them and getting little payoff for their efforts. Polar bears are feeding on ducks and geese, catching them when they're flightless and molting, as well as on their eggs, says Pagano. Other foods on the desperate bears' menus includes berries and other vegetation, bones, antlers, and in one case, a beluga whale carcass. None of that fare is caloric high and a steady diet of live blubber-packed seals. In the 1980s, polar bears were on land for about 110 days out of the year, with no need to eat terrestrial food since the fat deposits they had accumulated thanks to the wintertime seal hunting was enough to carry them the rest of the year. Now they're off the ice for 130 days on average. It's a measure of nutritional knife's edge on which the bears operate that just 20 days can make the difference between whether they live and thrive or starve and die. Next we have, in the health section, 5 low-stress ways to start decluttering. And this is by Angela Haupt. None of the tidying cliches ever clicked with Casey Davis, a therapist in Houston and mom to 2 young kids. "I've always been a messy person," she says. "I've never been able to clean as I go." Davis knew there were plenty of people just like her, those who wanted a serene space but lacked the time and energy to get started. After finding bite-sized strategies that worked for her, Davis wrote How to Keep House While Drowning, a gentle approach to cleaning and organizing. A messy house can feel overwhelming to tackle, and progress may seem incremental at first. But there's good reason to work on building a healthier relationship with your home. Research suggests that clutter increases levels of stress hormones, cortisol, and that cleanliness is associated with better self-rated health. Other studies have found that being surrounded by lots of excess stuff contributes to procrastination, diminished focus, and leads to decreased life satisfaction. We asked Davis and other experts to share their favorite strategies to kickstart a realistic decluttering routine. Number 1. Tackle one category at a time. One day, Davis looked at her messy room and realized that every item could be sorted into one of 5 categories: trash, dishes, laundry, items that have a place, like books that belong on the shelf, and odds and ends that do not. She started cleaning up by category and then found a home for her random objects. "I will get a trash bag and pick up all the trash. And then I get my laundry basket and pick up all the laundry," she says. It provided a really simple roadmap for my brain. Number 2. Edit your wardrobe automatically. Every New Year's Eve, Matt Paxton, author of Keep the Memories, Lose the Stuff, turns all the hangers in his closet around so they're hanging backwards on the rod. When you wear the item, you turn the hanger the other way, he says. The hanger trick gives Paxton visual proof of what he actually wore that year and which clothes languished in the closet. "You can't argue with that," he says. "Anything he didn't wear, he donates." Number 3. Scan your stuff. Sentimental items like photos and kids' art can be emotionally difficult to toss. First, get rid of the negatives, the duplicates, the generic landscape shots, and pictures of people you don't know or even like, says Paxton. Then digitize the rest by scanning them into your computer or phone using an app like Google Photo Scan. You can even preserve the memories through a combination of images, audio, visual, and text. The app Artifacts lets Paxton digitize his 7 kids' artwork this way. Every week he takes a photo of the latest creation and records them talking about it. Each kid chooses 1 piece of art to keep per year, and the rest live on in digital form. Number 4. Make donating part of your routine. Giving things away feels most meaningful when you pick a cause that you support. Some ideas. Dress for Success provides used professional attire to low-income women. One Warm Coat gives free coats to people in need. And Souls for Souls distributes footwear to people with limited resources. If you donated to a local thrift store, keep a box in the trunk of your car. Otherwise, the pile might never leave your house. Then once a week, drop it off. Doing so has become a normal Saturday for me, says Paxton. And lastly, number 5, we have Gamify the Purge. Enlist the kids with the 20 Things game, says Deborah Gilman, a psychologist in Pittsburgh. Set a timer for 20 minutes and challenge each family member to find 20 items to donate, sell, or throw away. I tell people to do this a couple times a year, like when the seasons are changing, she says. Make it a race to see who collects their items first. The prize could be choosing what movie to watch together that night. Now let's head over to Health Matters by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. February brought big COVID-19 news. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, is weighing a change to its long-standing isolation guidance, according to reporting from the Washington Post. Instead of telling people with COVID-19 to stay home for at least 5 days, the agency may soon say that they can go back to their normal lives once they've been fever-free for 24 hours and their other symptoms are mild and improving. The CDC has not confirmed that this policy change is coming. Would such a shift be the right call? Even the experts do not agree. The virus that causes COVID-19 has not evolved to be anything less contagious, and research shows that many people who catch it test positive and remain potentially infectious for even longer than 5 days. It would be really strange for the CDC to relax its guidance and give people the green light to go back into the world while they still could be spreading the virus, says Eleanor Murray, an epidemiologist at the Boston University School of Public Health. But people's tolerance for public health precautions has plummeted, according to Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And isolating for 5 full days is a burden on people who must work in person or don't have paid sick leave. You have to face reality, he says. At this point, the reality seems to be that people are moving on from COVID-19, whether guidance tells them to or not. For more news, you can sign up to healthmatters@time.com/health-matters. Next, we have the D.C. brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez erupted on the national stage back in 2018, a lot of establishment Washington braced for the arrival of a Tea Party-style troublemaker from the left. 6 years later, that assessment was so wrong as undercooked. While the former bartender remains a key ally to the left, AOC's main job in 2024 may be President Joe Biden's most valuable pinch hitter. As mainstream Democrats were tearing their hair out over the new questions about the president's mental acuity, there was Ocasio-Cortez on February 13th not only reaffirming her backing of Biden, but not so subtly slapping down those in her wing of the party screaming for him to step down. "I know who I'm going to choose. It's going to be one of the most successful presidents in modern American history," she told CNN. The boosterism came in the wake of a special counsel's damning report that blasted Biden as a forgetful figure who would be impossible to convict on charges that he mishandled classified information because he so obviously aged. The White House and its allies called the report hackish and a hit job. But nonetheless, Democratic insiders dispatched all available surrogates to spin the reports that Robert Hur's disclosure about Biden's alleged diminished faculties were misleading and inappropriate. And when needed the most, those allies included Ocasio-Cortez as part of the establishment defense. That turn of events is deeply frustrating to many of those who first helped Ocasio-Cortez, a self-described Democratic socialist, get to Washington by toppling a 10-term Democratic incumbent who was fourth most powerful figure in the House. In the time since, she has found the solid footing of a pragmatic disruptor. She'll cause trouble, as she did last year in opposing a must-pass spending bill, but not needlessly or without purpose. As a pragmatist, she understands that absent a health emergency, Biden is the Democratic nominee. While most Americans, 86% in the most recent ABC News poll, say Biden is too old for another term, compared with 62% who say the same thing about 77-year-old former President Donald Trump, this truth also holds. Democrats have no plausible off-ramp from Biden at this moment. Ocasio-Cortez saw this coming all the way back in July, when she announced her endorsement of Biden for a second term. "I think he's done quite well given the limitations that we have," Ocasio-Cortez says of Biden on Pod Save America, a podcast helmed by insiders of the Obama political machine. Democrats are now in a race to simultaneously cast Biden as a vigorous incumbent who's up to the task while also saying that Trump is just as old. That tension was clear as Ocasio-Cortez made her defense of Biden. "I think right now, when it comes to the president's age, folks are talking about how he's 81, she says. Donald Trump is around the same age. They could have gone to high school together. And beyond that, Donald Trump has 91 indictments. This pluck helps to explain why Ocasio-Cortez may be more important to Biden's reelection than many in Washington realize. For the very voters who are feeling left out of Biden's to-do list, the young voters, voters of color, women, Ocasio-Cortez may what saves those worries. Ocasio-Cortez understands this. Biden's team understands this. Which is to say, as Biden's campaign weighs how to deploy the army of surrogates ready to shore up support over the next 9 months, one of the most powerful VIPs may be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It didn't come to be just by accident, either. For more insights from Washington, you could sign up for Time's political newsletter at time.com/the DC Brief. And I think we have time for one more. The Leadership Brief by Sean Gregory, senior sports correspondent. First, Formula One got hot in the U.S. and beyond. Then came the pickleball craze, which started during the pandemic and hasn't lost much momentum. Which niche sport will break out next? Russell Coutts, the CEO of the upstart professional racing organization, SailGP, is making his case for sailing, that genteel, elitist country club pastime, which is indeed gaining some momentum in the United States. Coutts, the five-time America's Cup winner, the 1984 Olympic gold medalist, and two-time World Sailor of the Year, co-founded SailGP in 2018, along with Oracle founder and chairman Larry Ellison. Coutts met with Time in New York City in mid-January to discuss the trajectory of SailGP, the circuit's high-tech catamarans, and the challenges facing the sport. This interview has been condensed and edited for clarity. For those who are not familiar, what is SailGP? He says sailing did not have a regular annual championship that was professionally televised and marketed before SailGP. We have fast hydrofoiling boats. Other people have referred to it as Formula One-style championship on water. Next question, why do you have faith that SailGP can become the next Formula One? He says audience growth is the first thing. Second, the commercial model is strong. We started selling teams between $5 million and $10 million. Now you can't buy a team without $35 million. Next question. Sorry to introduce some skepticism to the Formula One comparison, but why would a fan prefer watching SailGP catamarans topping out at speeds of 60 miles an hour on water when the Formula One cars can exceed 200 miles an hour? He says it's the same people watching. The learning we have is that as long as it's a good race, they will watch. Next we have, is there anything you learned from your career as a skipper that you've brought to running the SailGP? He says anyone who gets to the top of the sport, you don't have to get there with talent alone. I got there by outworking the opposition. That work ethic has really helped me in my career. So sailing has a reputation as an elite white sport. And he says, yes, absolutely. We say that's a problem, and we want to change that. Last question. Having high-profile black investors like Issa Rae, who now has a stake in a U.S. team, can help change that perception. How else do you build diversity? He says we go to a place like the Middle East, which some people say conflicts with your environmental objectives. I disagree. To me, it's an exciting new territory where hopefully we can add some value, particularly with the younger generation. I'm really excited about those sorts of places. We shouldn't be closed-minded. We should be connecting with people. That makes us much more likely to understand each other. And if you want to sign up for more weekly conversations with the world's most influential leaders, you can go to time.com/leadership. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from Time Magazine, the March 11, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.